Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, down to Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallapoosa, Glen Rock, Black Rock, Little Rock, Oskaloosa, Tennessee, Tennessee, Chicopee, Spirit Lake, Grand Lake, Devil's Lake, Crater Lake, Beach Lake. I've been everywhere, man. I've been.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Flawless once again, Audrey. Thank you very much for being our spiritual and technical advisor for the show. You got us on one more time. What show number are we up to? We're getting pretty close to 100, I think, so we need to think about that. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley. We want to thank Johnny Cash, as we usually do, for taking us on that marvelous trip across the United States. Yes, John, the gas and diesel prices are down a little bit, so you probably enjoy it, but he takes us to more than 90 cities and states across the United States, and it's remarkable that if you knew about Johnny Cash and that song, he actually sings that song from memory. Most people could not do that. Emily and Mike, good to see you with us tonight. Thanks for picking up the news stories for us and giving us a little commentary and some notes. And, yes, Harold the goldfish, the most marvelous goldfish in the world, he's here too tonight. And I think he's interested in this show particular because mystery is in the air. Yes, we'll keep that for a surprise for a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, the purpose of our show is the same as it is every week. We try to discuss news, issues, events, any kind of developments in the always difficult, sometimes humorous field of criminal justice. I think there's a couple crackers here we got tonight that are that are interesting, not supposed to be so funny, but they are in terms of news stories. Our show is dedicated to the tireless police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and indeed around the world. What we try to do here is look inside criminal justice practice and take a close look at its professionals. And somebody once says we're kind of the NPR of criminal justice. We'll accept that as a compliment in almost all cases. You're listening to either on your cell phone or on the radio, the Blog Talk Radio Network. And Alan Levy is the CEO and the genius behind this this particular medium. And as I say every week, and we're proud of to be a little part of that, is that Blog Talk Radio Network is now BTR, is one of the top 100 websites in the world. And that puts them in there with Google and iTunes and YouTube and MySpace and places like that. And that's, you know, how many millions of websites are there now? In fact, I read an article in the New York Times this morning that was saying that they're running out of numbers in terms of identifying all these particular sites. So maybe the price of your site will go up and you'll sell out eventually. But what you can do with this radio network, ladies and gentlemen, is any person, any interest group, any organization can have their own show. They can broadcast live and streaming audio over the internet to an unlimited number of listeners. Unlimited number of listeners worldwide, and it's absolutely free. And I think you can do more than 14 hours, maybe 20 hours a week now. I haven't checked that. 1 hour is enough for me, but some folks are on there every day talking about something, pitching something, discussing something. And these shows run from, from the really totally informal, it's a conversation, let's get together once or twice a week and talk, to some shows that are really very professionally produced with professional music and cut-ins and cut-outs and all the kind of things that you would expect from a regular AM or FM broadcast network. These shows are archived immediately, so you can replay them or you can download them and keep them and use them, for example, in classes. We know that some people occasionally use our shows in criminal justice and criminology classes across the United States because they've told me that. So I would encourage you to get your own show. Log in some of the stuff. It's a great mechanism to be used in like research projects because you could actually do oral histories sort of right on the radio network. You'll have the thing all archived and you can deploy it any way that you would wish. So there's all kinds of opportunities for it. We might take a show some night and deal with different ways that this network could be used in research. And I think universities and colleges are starting to pick up on this idea. I saw that I've mentioned several times the Columbia School of Broadcasting, broadcast journalism. They're now using the network to host one of their shows about their school and introduce their faculty and that type of thing. What we're going to do tonight is what we normally do. We're going to take a look at some of the criminal justice news, not a lot of it. I've got three little segments tonight that I want to play. And you folks that are CSI fans and watch that show religiously, and boy, I guess they are. We got CSI all over the place. But the CSI show was about the application of science toward the solution of crime. And tonight, we're going to play some old-time radio, yes, one more time, but you'll never guess who the detective is tonight. It's Dr. Tim Detective. And I'll bet there's not 10 listeners. I'll take that back. There aren't 3 listeners out there that have ever heard of that particular radio show. They were rather short segments, about 12 to 15 minutes, but very interesting. And the doctor's assistants were 2 children, a young guy and a young girl, and you'll hear them a lot in the episodes tonight, but they're really science-related type of stories where science is used toward resolving some type of a problem in the community or resolving some type of crime. So we'll do that. You're listening either on the computer or on your cell phone, and you know that you can actually call in to our news during our news segment if you want to do that. There's supposed to be a click to contact or click to play on the website. I haven't actually seen that on my side when I'm on the switchboard, but you can click on that and call right in. You don't even need to use a cell phone. If you're going to use a cell phone, you can call in on 347-996-5983. That's 347-996-5983. On the news segment, you're welcome to call in on that. Now, ladies and gentlemen, as we say every week, Audrey England, our spiritual and technical advisor for the show, is a blonde, and she is a collector of blonde jokes. And she has another one for us tonight. Audrey, I like this one. I like horses, and this one is about horses. So go ahead and tell us about this one. It's a blonde joke about 2 horses, right, Audrey?
Right.
Professor Haley, tonight's blonde joke is about horses. I love horses. Here it is. A blonde bought 2 horses and could never remember which horse was which. A neighbor suggested that she cut the tail of one horse, and that worked great until the other horse got his tail caught in a bush. It tore just right and looked exactly like the other horse's tail, and our friend was stuck again. The neighbor suggested she notch the ear of one horse. That worked fine until the other horse caught his ear on a barbed wire fence. Once again our friend couldn't tell them apart. The neighbor suggested she measure the horses for height. When she did, she was very pleased to find that the white horse was 2 inches taller than the black horse.
Okay, I'll put that up as a B+, Audrey, A-. and keep that one. We may use that again. To our knowledge, in all the shows that we've done, we've never used the same joke twice. So if somebody finds that we have, write in and let us know, and you'll be our joke discerning winner for that particular week. But ladies and gentlemen, on a much more serious note, we know that firearms are responsible for so many deaths in the United States each year, and these crimes are perpetrated by street criminals and gang criminals and that type of thing. So the High Coalition Against Gun Violence has a public service announcement that they would like all of the gangbangers and street criminals to hear tonight, particularly those carrying firearms, in hopes that they'll go ahead and hear this message and get down to the local police department or sheriff's department and turn in their weapons.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition. And we hope the right people hear that message and take the particular remedial action that they're supposed to take. I was speaking with a friend in Texas the other day, a doctor who works at University of Texas at Dallas, and he was telling me that Texas not too long ago, I'm not sure how far back, but I wasn't aware of this, they revised their right to carry law. You can get a right to carry permit, of course, in Texas, and it's probably easily the most difficult one in the United States because you have to go through so many record checks and five different record checks, and they even check for your taxes, whether you paid your taxes. But then you go through classroom training and, of course, firearms training in a competitive exam, both written and on the range. In other words, a performance test. So it's very stringent, and of course, if you have that concealed carry license, you can carry a weapon in your car. But what Texas has done, they've taken the Castle Doctrine. They were a state that, remember, Ohio adopted that about 3 weeks ago, a month ago. The Castle Doctrine says when somebody breaks in your house, you no longer have a duty to retreat, and as they come forward to you, the assumption is that they're going to do you serious bodily harm or even take your life. So in essence, you can, in fact, use deadly force against them. Well, Texas has gone ahead and moved that into the automobile. So if you're traveling in an automobile without a concealed carry license, you are now permitted to carry a loaded firearm in that arm, in that car, as long as it's concealed. I think the deal is you have to have it covered in a glove box or somewhere so children can't easily get it, but it doesn't have to be locked up. So I'm not sure I don't follow those laws that close, at least the development of them anymore. Although I'm interested in them, that's a step forward. I don't know if any other state has done that exactly. Now, other states have exceptions based on where you're traveling and all kinds of things. But this sort of evens up the score in Texas because Texas always did allow you to carry, for example, a loaded sawed-off shotgun as long as the barrel wasn't shorter than 18 inches and violate federal firearms law. But you could carry that concealed in your car without any type of license. So, and again, I always like to point out to students and others that think, well, whoa, what a hideous thing for a state to do and permit what's happening there. And of course, my answer to that is there's no bloodbath in Texas. There's no bloodbath in Vermont where you don't even need a concealed carry license to carry concealed. So that's largely overstated. And I think in terms of accidental deaths, I haven't checked lately, but it used to be cigarette lighters cause more deaths than the others. Well, let's take a look at some of these news stories tonight. You've probably already heard about this one because I picked this one up, I guess, a couple of days ago. But this happened in Philadelphia, Citizens Bank Park. And they brought the bomb squad out to the Citizens Park because somewhere right inside the park they found several hot dogs wrapped up in foil, aluminum foil wrappers. And they said that, I guess, one of them had, like, duct tape on it or something like that, but they vacated the entire park. This happened sometime in the late afternoon, and the Phillies were going to take on the Atlanta Braves that night at 7:05, and it sounded like somebody had a tailgate party planned or something, and the hot dogs got out of control. But I think at one time or another, I've even been guilty of taking hot dogs into a park like that, you know, if you went to a tailgate party or something. So be careful. What happened, all the fans inside the stadium were evacuated, and the players remained on the field during the incident. They sent bomb squad members in to investigate, and they determined that this was simply several hot dogs. Sadly, the wieners were detonated as a precaution, the writer says, for the newscast. Anyway, kind of interesting. You know, this is the political season, as you may have noticed on television, radio, newspapers, and other media. But kind of interesting what's going on here, working in the university myself, or what's happened at the University of Illinois campuses. You cannot drive a car with a campaign bumper sticker. University System's Ethics Office sent a notice to all employees, including faculty members, telling them that you could not wear political buttons on campus or feature bumper stickers on cars parked in campus lots unless the messages on those buttons and stickers were strictly nonpartisan. So in addition, these professors were told that they could not attend political rallies on campuses, even if those rallies expressed support for a candidate of a particular express support for a particular political party. Now, that's interesting because universities do this, I think, pretty much all the time, don't they? They'll bring a candidate in, they'll have a political rally on campus. Often they'll bring in the opposing candidate, one from the other party. But I guess the University of Illinois faculty is kind of in a huff about this. They're saying, whatever happened to our free speech and our right to talk and that type of thing? One guy's got a, what has he got? He's got a bumper sticker says something like, "My Samoan, my dog is a Republican," and he's wondering if he's going to be picked up by the button police for something like that. So that's really kind of too much, isn't it? I wanted to mention this story because I love technology myself and my simple little world of computers and communication devices. I probably like to stay out front on that type of thing, but we now have Homeland Security is now going to be detecting terrorist threats by reading your mind. Wait a minute. Harold just did a flip in his water, my goldfish here. Yes, Homeland Security, among other things, is now going to detect terrorist threats by reading your mind. Bag searches are, the author, his Allison Berry, says they're so early 21st century. Homeland Security is now testing the next generation of security screening. This is a body scanner that can read your mind. I'm not kidding. It says many preventive screening looks for explosives or metals that pose a threat. But a new system called Malintent turns the old-school approach on its head. The Orwellian-sounding machine detects the person, not the device, set to wreak havoc and terror. This is the brainchild of cutting-edge human factors division and Homeland Security's Director for Science and Technology. And this is not a polygraph test, but what it does is it has sensors and imagers that read your body temperature, your heart rate, your respiration. For unconscious, it tells invisible to the naked eye. It signals terrorists and criminals may just, and it gives you signals that terrorists and criminals may be ready for an attack. What it says here is that this doggone thing, while they tested 144 subjects on this thing and gave them devices that would be characteristic of things that somebody would carry, and once it detects all this, it reads all this stuff, then it starts looking at your face, Malcontent does, and it's ready to define and measure seven primary emotions and emotional cues that are reflected in contractions of the facial muscles. I don't think I've ever met very many police officers. I always thought when you talk to a police officer, you could never tell what they were thinking. This is sort of a deadpan, sort of straight look that they get from having heard everything in life. I mean, what's going to upset them after they see so much through the police experience? But anyway, this is what's new. So you could be running into a malintent somewhere in an airport, and it's also portable. So they can take it. It says they can take it to bus stations. They can take it to airports, to stadiums and malls. So if you're going to some kind of big game, this thing will be looking for biological, radiological, explosive detection. I mean, this thing seems like the panacea for all terrorist threats. But remember, be careful taking those hot dogs into the ballpark because that could throw things off also. You know, last week we mentioned a woman in Howell, Michigan, whose four bulldogs killed the 91-year-old man. Folks remember that? 91-year-old man, and I think the 55, 57-year-old woman who was also jogging or walking by. And she got something like 15 years, or 45 months, 43 months to 15 years. And I think I even mentioned last week, didn't I, Mike, that famous case in San Francisco where the woman was mauled trying to get into her apartment? Yes, I did. And you know that a few days later, September 23rd, this shows up in the newspaper, that case wasn't over. That case occurred in 2001, that attack. San Francisco Superior Court judge sentenced a woman to 15 years to life in prison on Monday for her role in this infamous fatal dog mauling. This came a month after the judge, Charlotte Woolard, reinstated a second-degree murder conviction against the woman, Marjorie Knoller, stemming from the 2001 attack that killed Ms. Knoller's neighbor, Diane Whipple. Ms. Whipple was a 33-year-old lacrosse coach, and she was attacked in the hallway of her apartment building by two 120-pound dogs. She was bitten more than 75 times. So she was convicted of second-degree murder. They set aside that conviction and charged her with a involuntary manslaughter, and she was sentenced to 4 years in prison, and she would be released on parole shortly thereafter. But what's happened is they reinstated the murder case, so now she's sent to prison for could be as much as life, I suppose. But I'm telling you, I am one for punishing these people that allow these dogs to run free. I think, what kind of dogs were these? These weren't pit bulls. What kind of dog? Oh, yeah, it's a, I don't even know how you pronounce it. It's a Presa Canario. I guess it's a big, powerful breed dog. Another one to be afraid of, I guess. But isn't it incredible that something like that could actually happen? Well, ladies and gentlemen, what I think we'll probably do is look at one more story, and then we'll take a look at Dr. Tim Detective. And I think from a historical point of view, you'll really enjoy listening to these shows, because not only is the guy's a good actor and a good radio voice and that type of thing, but he uses these children to assist him in the resolution of these scientific problems that he encounters. I was talking to someone on the phone the other day, and they said that their son, or this woman said that her son sent 12,000 text messages in 1 month. Well, you know, the world's turned against the text messengers as they drive. That's for sure. And I think three or four states have now made that unlawful, and it's being introduced in more and more states as a proposed law that you can't text message. But one of the scientific people here, a guy named Paul Sappho, he says that as soon as you start text messaging and you're driving, your IQ goes down about 10 points because your concentration is split on at least two different things. And you're not bright enough, or you're not as bright as you were in terms of driving at the wheel. But I don't know of a person that probably hasn't seen somebody text messaging down the road and going all over the place, backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards, but I mean side to side. And this is very, very dangerous. And it says here that Consumer Research Company says 50,000 individual customer accounts in the second quarter of this year found that Americans each sent or received 357 text messages a month. And that's light for some people. Some of these young people are now doing 500 text messages a month. That's a 21-year-old student. Other people are doing 1,500 text messages a month, 2,000 text messages a month. And one of the guys in here in the story is talking about how wonderful these things are. You know, I don't want to know a lot of stuff. I just want to know where you are. Like, what are you doing? And you write back whatever that symbol is to justify what you're doing. But I think you're going to see more and more states turn against this, at least in terms of operating an automobile. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, some of the larger East Coast cities, at least one or two of them, actually makes it illegal to text message or use your cell phone while you're crossing the street in the interest of preventing pedestrian injuries. Well, ladies and gentlemen, let's take a little slip back in time. And let's look at the forerunner of the whole CSI movement and take a look at this feature character called Dr. Tim Detective. And I've got three short episodes here, tonight, and I think I'm going to start out with the one that has to do with a called Poisoner at Large. Very interesting, interesting little case, and I think you'll certainly enjoy these characters. So here we go. We're going to be talking about a old-time radio show where we had a doctor who used his medical and scientific knowledge toward the solution of the crime, and the character is called Dr. Tim Detective. The first episode is called Poisoner at Large.
This is Dr. Tim Detective to bring you by transcription the mystery of the Poisoner at Large. It isn't very often these days that you run across a case of wholesale poisoning. But when you do, well, there's never a dull moment until you've tracked the whole thing down. There's nothing worse than to be poisoned, whether you take the wrong medicine out of your medicine cabinet by mistake, or whether it's fed to you by somebody else, as it was in this particular case which came to my attention not so long ago. But I'd better start right at the beginning. Sandy and Jill, they're a couple of my very best friends and helpers, were watching me at work in my laboratory this particular evening, and, as usual, the questions flew thick and fast.
Sure, I get the general idea, but what's that machine for?
It sure makes enough racket.
Well, as I was saying, it's called a centrifuge.
That explains everything, I guess.
Yeah, I can see it just about as easy as a black sheep in a coal mine, at night.
Okay, kid, I'll back up a little. You see, when you have several kinds of bacteria, or bugs, I guess you'd call them, or when you want to separate one part of a substance from another, you put them in a centrifuge, turn on the switch, and the machine whirls them around at a few thousand revolutions per minute.
Then what happens?
Presto, like this. Centrifuge separates the lighter from the heavier parts. In this case, the bacteria I'm hoping to find from the solution they grew in. And, well, here you are. Look for yourselves.
Hey, it worked.
I'll be darned.
Now, I'll transfer these bacteria to a culture.
Here we go again.
Well, a culture is merely something for the bacteria to grow in and feed from.
Oh.
In this case, I'm going to use the fertilized egg of a chicken. And if the experiment works, I'll soon know if these bacteria can live and grow in living tissue. At other times, the culture might be milk or a sugar solution or even a bit of custard pie. It's a way we scientific detectives have of finding out a lot of things.
I don't see much detective work there.
Yeah, you'd be surprised, Sandy. You'd be surprised. Hello.
Hello, Tim. Is that you?
Oh, hello, Jarvis. How are things down at the health department?
Well, we could sure use you right now if you've got the time. We're pretty short-handed, and something's come up I don't like at all. Right in your neighborhood.
Well, anything serious?
14 calls during the last hour, and all from your part of town. Food poisoning, I think.
Any clues?
Not yet. Haven't had time to check thoroughly. Thought you might help there. Like to get out your set of false mustaches and do a little detective work?
Why, Dr. Jarvis, you know us junior G-men have given up disguises. The latest thing is to graft noses on us like a bloodhound.
All right, anyway, please. Now, I'll give you a list of the names and addresses of everybody we have that's been reported so far. And let you get to it.
A few minutes later, Sandy, Jill, and I were mapping out our campaign. Now, some people think it's kind of funny for a combination doctor and detective to count on a couple of kids for help on a case. But let me tell you that those two are just about the most valuable assistants I have. In between phone calls reporting new cases of food poisoning, we outlined the problem and our work.
So you mean you'd like us to get a complete list of everything the sick people ate today?
Exactly. And then by putting those lists together, we ought to find that all of them had one kind of food somewhere along the line, or ate at the same restaurant, perhaps. In other words, you see, we need a common factor to start with.
I get it. You're trying to track down where the food poisoning came from.
Exactly. And that way, we can stop anyone else from eating the contaminated food.
But gee, what is it? Arsenic or rat poison or something?
Well, that's what I'm going to find out by a careful laboratory analysis after I visit a couple of those sick people. However, I'm willing to bet that we'll find our old friends, the bacteria, at the bottom of it.
Germs, huh?
Yes. Well, let's get going, kid.
some canned soup and cream pie. Oh, yes. Dr. Glenn would like to know where you bought the pie, or if
you... I think you have it right, Miss Garrett. You and your wife ate hamburgers, canned pork and beans, and drank coffee. Dr. Tim told me to ask you where you bought the hamburgers. The rest of the things don't matter.
And you didn't eat anything at home, is that right? Now, I'm supposed to find out a quick guess down to your
table. Thanks. Now, let's be sure I have it right. Steak, potatoes, fresh carrots, and chocolate eclairs. For sure that's everything. Dr. Tim wants to be sure.
By the time I arrived home after looking in on some of the patients, I had enough laboratory material to keep me busy for quite a spell. Samples of food from several homes, minute bits of waste from the patients, and lists similar to those Sandy and Jill were compiling. I went into my laboratory and sat down for a few moments to think. So far, nothing about the case made sense, except that all those people did have food poisoning. None about that. And some of them were mighty sick indeed. There'd be a lot more if we didn't track down the source of the trouble in a hurry, stop anyone else from eating the germ-laden food. Silently, I went to work. A few minutes later, Sandy and Jill were going over their lists of the food eaten by the poisoned patients with Dr. Jarvis. And as I adjusted my microscope for the umpteenth time, I found what I was looking for. I motioned the others over. Well, here's the criminal.
Can you let me see?
Yeah, me too.
They all peered into the microscope. Dr. Jarvis was the first to speak.
Nasty little germ, salmonella.
What salmonella?
I suppose it accounts for more food poisoning than all the other bacteria put together. Doesn't kill very many people. It sure makes a lot of them plenty sick.
Did you find out where it came from?
Unfortunately, no. There aren't any samples of the food I've tested so far that show its presence. The bacteria you see under the microscope are from the stomach contents of one of the patients.
Well, we're not having too much luck ourselves. Like to hear the reports of the investigation?
I think that's the next step.
Okay, Jill, you've been keeping score. Suppose you start.
Well, there isn't any one food that everybody ate.
No. Wouldn't you know it?
Oh, it's worse than that. There aren't even two kinds of food on everybody's list. I mean, you know, half of them one thing and half another.
Mm-hmm.
Just plain doesn't make sense.
It looks like a dead end from here.
Well, let's do the best we can. Let's find the, say, the three items that appear oftenest in the list you've made. And just might be a connection. First, though, I think we can rule out canned food, because there hasn't been any real trouble with commercially canned food for years. And it's impossible that all those people ate the same home canned stuff that might have gone bad. This is going to be tougher than I thought. The results of our detective work were peculiar, to say the least. But we did prove one thing. There were three food items to be suspected. Because one of those three appeared in all the diets of the ones who ate at home. With a flourish of his pencil, Dr. Jarvis summed it up.
Well, here we are. Those poisoning people had either hamburger in some form, cream pie, or chocolate eclairs. Doesn't make sense.
Wait a minute, I've got an idea. I've been working on the ones who ate out, and all of them had one of those three.
Hold on a minute.
When do you hear this one? I've been doing the scores in the restaurants. Everybody that ate out went to the drugstore down on the corner.
This is beginning to add up to something.
Let me see your list, Joe. No, the other one. All the pastry, the cream pies, and the chocolate eclairs came from one bakery.
Oh, sure, and we have meatballs, hamburgers, meatballs, and tamale pie, all made with ground meat from the same butcher shop.
You're sure of that?
Uh-huh.
Now all we have to do is to chase all over town to those various stores, trying to find out what and why.
Gosh, no, you don't.
Don't what?
Don't have to chase all over town, or even this end of it. That bakery and the meat market and the drugstore where the people ate are all right together. Just four blocks down the street.
Say, wait a minute. If that's true, Jarvis, I think we might have the answer. Let's get going. Fast.
Come on, let's go. Come on.
As we drove the short distance to the shopping center, I got to thinking. You know, it's a funny thing about mysteries, especially complicated ones like this one, where people scattered over a wide area all come down with the same illness at once. At first, things don't even make sense. Look impossible, you might say. And then, with a bit of information added here and there, a dim pattern begins to take shape. Well, that's exactly what happened in the poison mystery this time. Here's what we knew. Three food items caused those people to become deathly ill. Well, two, really, because it occurred to me that the filling of cream pie and the filling of chocolate eclairs is the same. And the other was hamburger. Both items came from the same two stores. Those who had eaten at the drugstore had eaten either hamburger or the cream filling. What would be more logical than for the drugstore food to be purchased at the butcher shop next door and the bakery two doors down? So the pattern was now clear. Only one part of the mystery remained. How could both the pastry and the hamburger become poisoned with the germs of salmonella? And as we drove up in front of the stores and parked, an almost forgotten item of my medical training popped into my mind. I was sure I had the answer. Well, as we gathered in my laboratory a little later, Sandy, Jill, Dr. Jarvis, and myself, we were a happy gang. There wouldn't be any more cases of food poisoning from that source, at least. Lost in thought, I heard Sandy ask,
"But gee, Dr. Tim, how come you went right into those stores and started looking for rats?"
"He sure fooled me."
"Well, as Dr. Jarvis could tell you as well as I, one of the commonest carriers of salmonella, the food poisoning bug, is rats and mice. A few of their droppings around a food store and... well, you've seen what happens."
"Oh, that's why we have inspections by the city and campaigns against rats and mice, even if you can't get results 100% of the time."
"Well, why would just the, will the cream filling in the hamburger be full of germs?"
"Well, you remember what I told you about cultures, the perfect material for bacteria to grow on?"
"Yeah."
"Sure."
"Well, two of the best cultures in the world for salmonella are cream fillings and ground meat, especially in a warm place like the bakery, or when left outside the refrigerator in a butcher shop. It's the perfect setup for an epidemic like ours."
"But why did those stores being right together give you the idea?"
"Elementary, my dear Sandy, elementary. It would be rather strange that two or three different sets of food poisoning would break out on the same day at widely separated spots. So figuring that adjoining buildings would offer plenty of opportunity for the same carriers to go back and forth freely, I apprehended the poisoners at large. It's a matter of get rid of the rats, get rid of the poisoners. And believe me, that's going to be done." This is Dr. Tim Detective, saying so long until next week at this same time, when Sandy, Jill, and I will bring you the exciting transcribed story I call The Mystery of the House That Jack Built.
That's a truism in a lot of venues, isn't it? Get rid of the rats and you get rid of the poison. But I hope you enjoyed that. Dr. Tim and his two young assistants are a very, very worthy investigative team. I think what we'll do is roll right over into another one that involves a, well, I shouldn't tell you what it involves because I'll let the story unfold. But this one is called the Guest in Number 2. So here we go with Dr. Tim Detective, old-time radio show going way back into the 1940s and 50s.
This is Dr. Tim Detective to bring you, by transcription, The Mystery of the Guest in Number 2. Being a combination of doctor and detective gets pretty rugged sometimes, and this was one of those times, all right. The Guest in Number 2, we called him. Jill, that's my landlady's daughter, first called him to my attention.
Mom's just rented number two. You know, the room up on the second floor. To the doggondest guy.
I remember you thought I was the doggondest guy when I moved in. And I set up a laboratory for crime detection and medical work.
Well, but Sandy thinks so too, don't you, Sandy?
Yeah, I think maybe he's a criminal in hiding.
I'm afraid you kids have developed unnatural suspicions from helping me out with some of my cases.
Well, anybody that says his name is Jones,
Now look. Some people really are named Jones. Several hundred thousand of them, I presume, and that's
Yeah, but if that's his name, then why are all his suitcases marked with R-W-M?
Sure, every one of them, stamped in gold letters.
None of our business, kids. Boy, your mother'd skin you alive, Jill, if she knew you were prying into the luggage of a paying customer. And as for you, Master Sandy, it might be smart for you to confine your detective work to your own premises and not in other people's houses, right?
Right.
Oh, okay, I guess. But I still think it is darn good.
I wish now I'd paid more attention to Sandy and Jill in the matter of the stranger in number two. But you never know until it's too late. Anyway, nothing happened to break the routine of my laboratory week for a couple of weeks. Then, late one afternoon, just before dinner time, I was cleaning up my lab.
Gee, Dr. Tim, you don't mean those jars are full of real blood. Blood from people.
Exactly that, Jill.
What do you do with it?
Oh, a lot of things. Blood's a pretty useful thing. A lot more so than most people realize.
Where do you get it?
From the bank, Jill. The blood bank. And that's just what it actually is. All over the country, these banks keep blood for use whenever and wherever it's needed.
Sure, but what do you do with it?
Well, that's a long story, Sandy. But it amounts to this. For years, doctors have known that blood isn't just one thing. It's lots and lots of things. And each one of those parts or fractions of the blood can be separated from the other parts. And these are used to cure people. I'm trying to find some new blood parts or some new uses for the old ones. That's why there's always blood samples in the laboratory refrigerator, catch?
Uh-huh.
Sure. Well, I'm all cleaned up here at last. Now, what's the news?
Mom said I'd better come up and see you.
Mm-hmm.
A professional visit, she called it. I don't feel so good today.
Symptoms?
Well, I've been sort of sick at my stomach and my eyes hurt. And I feel all kind of worn out.
Personally, I think she's just trying to get out of doing homework tonight.
I am not.
Well, let me take a look, Jill. Let's take out your tongue. Say off. Sandy.
Yes, Dr. Tim.
Hand me that thermometer, will you?
Sure.
Thanks. Here, I'll keep it in your mouth for a while, Jill.
Now, Dr. Tim.
Yes?
You know that guy Jones upstairs?
Oh, I wouldn't say I know him, Sandy. We've spoken in the hall.
Well, I know you told us to lay off, but the doggonest thing happened just a few minutes ago. While I was waiting by the stairs for Jill.
Ah, the curse of an overactive imagination. Go on.
Anyway, he came in with this other man right behind him. And Dr. Tim, I'd swear that other guy had a gun in his overcoat pocket, was pushing it right up against this Jones guy's back. They didn't see me.
I didn't have time to laugh because just at that moment, from right overhead came the sound of a fight. And then something else. A shot. For a moment, we stood there paralyzed. It wasn't until I heard a crash of glass and saw a figure hurtle past my window and streak it over the back fence and up the alley that I could move. And by the time that we reached the upstairs room, it looked as if we'd arrived too late. The mysterious Mr. Jones was lying on the floor with a pool of blood beside him. He'd been shot. Shot right through the back. Looking back on it afterwards, I don't know what I'd have done without those kids. There wasn't anybody else in the house. And if I ever needed six hands, I needed them then. Sick as she was, Jill just gulped and said,
"Holy gee. Is he dead?"
He wasn't quite, but it was a matter of moments. Gunshot wounds can be pretty nasty. Where there's loss of blood, you always have shock to contend with. And shock can be mighty serious in itself. Sandy didn't have to be told. In a flash, he was downstairs and back with my medical bag. One word to Jill, the word police, sent her flying to a telephone, and I knew an ambulance and help would be on the way at once. Meantime, the mysterious Mr. Jones was in the hands of God and a doctor. I hoped I was a good doctor, and I remember asking God to help me out on that score. Jones was dying, fast. Then I remembered that blood in my laboratory. Thank you.
Downstairs in the lab, Jill and I worked as we'd never worked before, while Sandy kept watch upstairs over the wounded man. We didn't talk much, Jill and I. Just a few quiet questions and answers.
Here's the microscope type, Dr. Kim. Are you going to give him a transfusion?
Yes. Have to check his type of blood first with a microscope. Use the wrong kind of blood and it would kill him.
What?
Good thing I have whole blood on hand for those experiments. He wouldn't last until they could get some here. Now, that solution, please.
Yeah.
Oh, this one seems to match his blood. Quick, hand me that bottle marked type O. Now, go to the sterilizer. Twenty minutes later, the ambulance arrived. Two squad cars and a dozen or so police were scouring the neighborhood for some trace of the man who had tried to murder the mysterious Mr. Jones. And as for Jones, that blood had saved his life, had replaced the vital fluid, the blood cells, and all the other chemical elements so necessary to keeping the life of a man going. Jones was still unconscious, of course, and would be for a long time yet. His condition was so serious that he couldn't even be moved to a hospital. It would have meant sure death from more loss of blood and shock. The case was out of my hands now, but I'd done my best, and I hoped my best was good enough. I sank down weakly in a chair in my laboratory. And it wasn't until I noticed Sandy and Jill, big-eyed and bursting with excitement, that I remembered the other side of the affair. Who had shot Jones, and why? Maybe I could help there, too. But one look at Jill, and I knew her heart was going to be broken. For this was one case where she was going to be out of the running. I spoke quietly. Jill.
Yes, Dr. Kim?
You're going to bed.
Oh, Dr. Kim!
Hate to do it to you, old girl, but you remember that little examination we were making?
Well, yes, but...
As your doctor, madam, I order you to bed. You have measles.
Oh.
A few minutes later, the house had two bed patients. One, a very sad young lady with measles. The other, a man nobody knew, who had almost been murdered. A third patient, Sandy, was standing up bravely under a light, while I stood over him with a hypodermic syringe.
What's the stuff, Doc?
Well, believe it or not, Sandy, it comes from blood, too. It's going to keep you from catching Jill's measles, or at least it'll make certain that you have a very light case and protect you for a long time afterwards.
What do you call it?
Immune serum globulin.
Well, let's skip that one, huh?
Well, you see, this stuff is one of those blood parts, fractions, I was telling you about. When you take blood from people who have had measles and separate it into its parts, this globulin...
Hey, how do you spell that one?
Well, G-L-O-B-U-L-I-N. It works wonders to keep people from getting measles from other people.
I'll take your word for it, Doc. Go ahead and shoot.
Okay.
I didn't even feel it. Am I safe now?
Perfectly safe.
Dr. Tim.
Yes?
You know, I've been watching that guy, Jones, the one who was shot. I can tell you something about him.
What?
He's loony. You know what he does?
No.
He collects rocks, believe it or not. Just common old rocks.
Well, that's a harmless pastime.
Sure got him in a mess of trouble.
Maybe you've got a point there, Sandy. But why would anybody shoot a man for collecting rocks? Unless, well, unless they were gold or something.
Whoever shot him was after those rocks, all right. When you left me alone with Mr. Jones in the room upstairs, I sort of noticed that several of his suitcases had been busted open. There were rocks with labels on them scattered all over the room. I'd sure like to know why.
It must have been midnight when I decided I couldn't get to sleep and might as well do a little looking around. After what we'd all been through, I wanted to forget the mystery and relax. The police could carry on from here. But I couldn't. So I went up the stairs to where the mysterious Mr. Jones hovered between life and death. I motioned the nurse to be silent and carefully examined the room. Sandy was right. There was nothing of interest except the rocks. There were hundreds of them, all sizes and all shapes, and all neatly labeled with cryptic little stickers which said Northwest 100A or South G8, referring no doubt to some location on a map where they had been gathered. I took a couple with me to examine at leisure in the laboratory and started downstairs when I noticed a light coming from under the door to Jill's room.
Come in.
Well, sort of late for a sick girl to be reading, isn't it?
Oh, honest, I've been asleep.
Well, it's lights out now. Doctor's orders.
Okay, doctor. hope, Mr. Jones. Is he going to live?
I wish I could tell you, Jill. The use of blood has given him a chance. First the transfusion, and then later maybe he'll need plasma.
What's that?
Oh, plasma's another part of blood, Jill. It can be stored indefinitely and won't spoil as quickly as whole blood. You use it when you don't need the red cells of the blood, just the liquid part.
Gee, Bud, it's still wonderful stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Chris, Dr. Jill, what are you doing with those rocks in your hand?
Oh, these? Well, they're from Mr. Jones' room. Seems to be a lot of them up there.
Are they anything special?
I don't know, Jill. Sandy mentioned them, and I thought...
Gee, Chris, I'll bet I know what they are. I was reading in the paper tonight. Everybody's out looking for them.
For what?
Well, gosh, I forget what you call it. But prospectors go out with some kind of electric machines, and they...
I just stood there with my mouth hanging open. What a dope I'd been. It took two kids to tell me what I should have seen from the very first moment. Without even saying goodnight to Jill, I dashed down the stairs, picked up the telephone, and called the Federal Bureau of Investigation. This was a case for the G-Man. It took a couple of weeks before the case was cleared up. My hunch, thanks to the work of Sandy and Jill, had been right. Jones had been prospecting for uranium, the vital mineral for atomic energy and research. Jones told us the whole story later, how he was prospecting for the government, which badly needed new supplies of uranium. How he'd been forced at the point of a gun to give up his map and then brutally shot. The G-men caught the man all right, but never gave out the whole story of who was behind the robbery and the attempted murder. But it wasn't anyone working for the good of this country. Jones had really found uranium, too. And the mine is being worked today. Thanks to Sandy, to Jill, and to a mysterious substance known for thousands and thousands of years as blood. This is Dr. Tim Detective, saying so long until next week at this same time, when Sandy, Jill, and I will dip into my casebook and bring out a brand new transcribed story, The Mystery of the Man from Trouble Creek.
Obviously, media productions and their content vary over time, don't they? But that's an interesting one, a real science put to work to resolve a criminal case there. And at the end, they brought in the FBI to work the case and resolve matters. But, you know, if you listen to something like this, it's cleverly done. These shows for about 12 minutes. And again, for those who can't even imagine, I can remember myself, but people used to sit around the radio and actually in a room and listen to these stories. If you go to archive.org, you can find, I think, about 12 or 15 of these Dr. Tim Detective episodes. I was going to play the other one tonight, The Man from Hiroshima, but we wouldn't be able to see the whole thing, I think, or hear the whole thing. It runs about 12 or 14 minutes. But I think the science in these is actually pretty good. I mean, there's a little learning exercise in each one of them relative to some scientific principle or principles. So I encourage you, if you're interested in that kind of stuff in old-time radio, I'm going to be writing a paper about these old-time radio shows here very shortly and kind of
doing an analysis of all the different kinds of detectives that used to appear on these shows. That's probably not that different than it is today. We have people from all walks of life who end up a detective. You think back through early television history up to the modern day. Of course, we've had cop service detectives, but we've had private investigators in wheelchairs. We've had private investigators who were unsighted, blind. We've had, this and that serving as detectives. I think I'll finish up tonight with a news story I didn't get to tonight, but let me ask you this question, folks. How much would it be worth to you to sleep on a mattress for, about 60 days and then being reimbursed by the state that puts you on that mattress when you're in prison? But here's a story of a pretty interesting story. Wisconsin man serving time for reckless homicide yesterday on September 19th was awarded $295,000 by a federal jury that found the inmate's constitutional rights were violated when he was forced to spend 2 months sleeping on a moldy, waterlogged mattress. Reggie Townsend, 29 years old, he got this six-figure windfall after a U.S. District Court panel decided he was improperly treated while locked up in late 2004 at the new Lisbon Correctional Facility or institution in Wisconsin. The jury special verdict can be found below, but it says this followed a jail riot, so they temporarily put him in this 12-by-6 segregation unit, and he was in there 60 days. He shared that space with another state inmate, and during the period, they found that Townsend had to sleep on the cell floor atop a thin mattress adjacent to the shower. The mattress, Townsend claimed, soon became wet and moldy and foul-smelling and was not replaced despite his complaints to the jail guards. But he didn't suffer any physical harm from the unsanitary bedding. He was deprived, the court said, of his minimal civilized measure of life's necessities. The jury decided after deliberating 6 hours, and Mr. Townsend collected nearly $300,000. Isn't that absolutely incredible? Might take a turn on a mattress for 60 days like that. I could collect about $300,000. I don't know how much he ends up getting in the end, but interesting little news story, one of the bizarre aspects of criminal justice. And, of course, he was denied his rights. They actually filed a claim against a particular corrections officer there in the state of Wisconsin. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's about all the time we have for tonight. And be sure to look at the show billing and see what we have coming up next. And I'm sure that we'll be meeting again, and we'll have Vera Lynn, as usual, take us out here tonight.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. Again. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know.